The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Oh, boy. Welcome to a Wednesday, everyone. I am Nicole Sandler, coming to you live here at NicoleSandler.com and, of course, through the magic of digital audio on the Progressive Voices Network, now heard Tuesdays through Fridays from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Voices. Oftentimes after I finish a show and I get the podcast posted and I, you know, finish all the post-production work, because I do everything myself here, I start thinking about, you know, the next day's show, and I start stressing over what I'm going to talk about when I open the microphone, because oftentimes there's too much. You know, there are a number of things that I could mention, but sometimes it seems not even worth a mention. And last night, it must have been, I don't know, around 9:30 or so, and David had walked in the other room and came back into the living room where I was sitting, and he said, "Did you hear what Trump said now?" I was like, "What?" And At first I thought he was kidding when he told me about Trump's latest tweet. But here's what he tweeted last night. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times. Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I too have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works. And I realized I had nothing to stress about, obviously. I could talk about the fact that the man who is, despite all common sense, the president of the United States is mentally unhinged. The man is, if he weren't so narcissistic and such a megalomaniac and so honestly mentally disturbed, I'd feel sorry for him, because he's got a really small penis. You know, you got to feel sorry for someone like that. But I don't feel sorry for him. I feel sorry for us. Does he not understand the seriousness about which he is joking? Well, today we have new answers to that. No, he obviously doesn't. And the reason I say we have new answers to that is there's a new book that's going to be out on the 9th. When is that? On Tuesday, it'll be officially released. It's called Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. And it's written by a guy named Michael Wolff. And Michael Wolff apparently had pretty much unfettered access to the White House or to the campaign when nobody thought Donald Trump would win. Even Donald Trump didn't believe he would win. And so today, first the first news about the book came via The Guardian. And then just shy of noon this afternoon, New York Magazine posted an excerpt of this book, and it shows how truly unhinged Donald Trump really is. And the excerpts that were posted today focus a lot on Steve Bannon. The first thing we got was Steve Bannon describing that Trump Tower meeting in June with Veselnitskaya, remember, you know, the Russian attorney, the one where they allegedly talked about adoption, which is, we know that what they did not talk about, you know, the one that was described to Don Jr. in an email as having dirt on Hillary. Yeah, that meeting. And Steve Bannon described that meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and a group of Russians as treasonous and unpatriotic. He warned that the investigation into alleged collusion with the Kremlin will focus on money laundering and predicted, quote, they're going to crack Don Jr. like an egg on national TV. Throughout the day, more came out about it. Peter Alexander of NBC News tweeted out, new, here's the Bannon quote regarding the July 2016 Trump Tower meeting. The chance that Don Jr. did not walk these, and there's the word JUMOS, J-U-M-O-S, up to his father's office on the 26th floor is zero. That's apparently on page 255 of the book. Well, I don't know what the word JUMO means, J-U-M-O. So I looked it up, and the closest I could find is it's a Spanish word for blind drunk. I don't know if that's what Steve Bannon meant in that quote, or if it's some other pejorative that I'm just not aware of. But, you know, when there's a word that I don't know, I look it up. And that's the best I could find was a Spanish to English translation of somebody who's blind drunk or wasted. Here's another from the excerpt. Shortly after 8 p.m. on election night, when the unexpected trend Trump might actually win seemed confirmed, Don Jr. told a friend that his father, or DJT as he calls him, looked as if he had seen a ghost. Melania was in tears and not of joy. There was, in the space of little more than an hour, in Steve Bannon's not unamused observation, a befuddled Trump morphing into a disbelieving Trump and then into a horrified Trump. But still to come was the final transformation. Suddenly, Donald Trump became a man who believed that he deserved to be and was wholly capable of being the president of the United States. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. See, they never believed that he would win, nor apparently, from what I read in the excerpt published in New York Magazine. I'll post a link to the excerpt on my blog today at NicoleSandler.com, along with the podcast and the show, should you care to read it. And it's even as stomach churning as it is, it's still interesting reading. Well, it gets even better, though, because the White House put out a statement. It's a statement from the President of the United States. I feel like we're living in some. I watched a lot of the Twilight Zone marathon over New Year's, and I feel like we're in the Twilight Zone. We are in. We're certainly in opposite worlds.
Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, opposite world.
So yes, it is. It is definitely opposite world, and it feels like we're in the Twilight Zone. Here is the statement put out by the White House, quote, Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Steve was a staffer who worked for me after I had already won the nomination by defeating 17 candidates, often described as the most talented field ever assembled in the Republican Party. Oh, my God. Now that he is on his own, Steve is learning that winning isn't as easy as I make it look. Steve had very little to do with our historic victory, which was delivered by the forgotten men and women of this country. Yet Steve had everything to do with the loss of a Senate seat in Alabama held for more than 30 years by Republicans. Steve doesn't represent my base. He's only in it for himself. But that's not all. It continues. Steve pretends to be at war with the media, which he calls the opposition party, yet he spent his time at the White House leaking false information to the media to make himself seem far more important than he was. It is the only thing he does well. Steve was rarely in a one-on-one meeting with me and only pretends to have had influence to fool a few people with no access and no clue whom he helped write phony books. And there's more. We have many great Republican members of Congress and candidates who are very supportive of the Make America Great Again agenda. Like me, they love the United States of America and are helping to finally take our country back and build it up rather than simply seeking to burn it all down. That's the end of the statement. Need I read you the tweet again about his button being bigger than Kim Jong-un's? Yeah, I didn't think so. Oh my God. We are in the Twilight Zone. We are in opposite world. But today we're going to focus in a little bit on some of the good things that happened last year, because The Nation magazine every year, the end of the year, puts out their progressive honor roll. So our guest today is John Nichols of The Nation, and we're going to recap some of the progressive honor roll of 2017. But first, a look at the news. We've got Ellen Ratner coming up after today's What's News.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Just when you hoped you'd never hear the president say something like this again.
Look at those hands. Are they small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee you.
He took to Twitter with something just as infantile but infinitely more dangerous.
President Trump took to Twitter this evening, writing, quote, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times. Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I, too, have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works, unquote. The bellicose back and forth comes as a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is warning that the U.S. is, quote, closer to a nuclear war with North Korea than ever before, adding that he did not, quote, see the opportunities to solve this diplomatically at this particular point. And President Trump this evening, he's in a back and forth with Kim Jong-un about whose nuclear button is bigger and whose is more powerful. It may be difficult for some of you at home to wrap your minds around a U.S. president who makes statements like this about the use of nuclear weapons, which would, of course, murder millions of people.
Despite Trump's assertions, he doesn't actually have a button. Just saying. Of that tweet, former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said,
there are potentially millions of lives at stake, an untold death and destruction here. And to me, it's very, very disturbing. No one in the White House knows what is Kim Jong-un's ignition point, where one of these tweets is going to set him off and he's going to hit that button.
But that wasn't the only eyebrow-raising tweet Trump sent out already in this new year.
The tweets about North Korea, two of 16 messages the president sent on a range of 16. Unrelated topics during his first day back in the Oval Office after the holiday break. Mr. Trump began the day attacking his own Justice Department as the deep state, referencing a conspiracy theory.
Obviously, he doesn't believe the entire Justice Department is part of that.
The president going after top former Hillary Clinton aide Huma Abedin, asserting that she should be jailed over her handling of State Department emails, despite the fact that after an FBI investigation, she has not been charged with a crime. President Trump also urging the Justice Department to act in prosecuting former FBI Director James Comey, fired by the president last May.
When I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story.
Other targets of the president's Twitter attacks, the New York Times, former President Barack Obama, Pakistan, Iran, and the Palestinians, who Mr. Trump threatened not to give future funding if they do not rejoin peace talks. President Trump also taking credit for a record year of safety in commercial aviation without citing any measures his administration has implemented.
Orrin Hatch, one of the president's biggest supporters in the U.S. Senate, is calling it quits at the end of this term after serving for more than 40 years.
After much prayer and discussion with family and friends, I've decided to retire at the end of this term. Although I will miss serving you in the Senate, I look forward to spending more time with my family, especially my sweet wife, Elaine, whose unwavering love and support made all of this possible.
Mitt Romney updated his Twitter profile to show that he's now from Utah rather than Massachusetts in preparation for an expected run for that seat. Meanwhile, Al Franken's Twitter bio has been updated to read, former U.S. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota, as his resignation became official at noon on Tuesday. His replacement, the Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota, Tina Smith, swearing in, happens Wednesday. And there's another swearing in at noon on Wednesday, as Doug Jones, the first Alabama Democrat elected to the U.S. Senate in 25 years, also takes the oath of office. 11 people have already died across the U.S. due to the brutal winter storm bearing down on the nation. The Washington Post reporting that the extraordinarily strong storm bearing down on the East Coast is strengthening as it heads north from Florida to Maine. It'll resemble a winter hurricane with snow and forceful winds. Authorities are urging people to stay indoors.
One third of the United States gripped by dangerous sub-zero temperatures. More than 100 million Americans under wind chill advisories. The deep freeze killing at least 11 people, including a 27-year-old woman in Wisconsin who wandered from a New Year's Eve celebration with her friends.
It looks to just be a very tragic accident.
In Texas, where 4 people have died of exposure, the Red Cross setting up additional warming centers across Houston. In the Midwest, the wind chill colder than on the surface of Mars. Waterways across the country, from rivers to lakes to waterfalls, frozen solid. Even Niagara Falls surrounded by sheets of ice. The wintry mix wreaking havoc on roadways, including a massive 75-car pileup on Interstate 90 near Buffalo, New York. In Massachusetts, firefighters struggling to work in the bitter cold.
The water freezes on our equipment, on our air packs, on our masks.
The punishing chill even hitting as far south as Alabama and Florida. Officials preparing shelters and warning residents to stay indoors as they brace for ice and snow.
If you don't have a reason to be out, don't be out. I got
the good. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution in the new year. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. All right, for a bit more of what's going on this busy news day, we turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at TalkMediaNews.com, and Ellen Ratner's on the line today. Hi, Ellen. Happy New Year.
Well, hi. I mean, I started covering the White House in 1993, and I have to tell you, I have never seen anything as astounding as I saw come from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, and she issued a statement supposedly written by the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll just give you a couple of highlights. Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. And then he said, Steve pretends to be at war with the media, which he calls the opposition party, yet he spent his time at the White House leaking false information to the media only to make himself seem far more important than he was. Then later on, the White House said, this is about a book that he talked about. He said, this book is filled with false and misleading accounts from individuals who have no access or influence with the White House. And then Mrs. Trump's press secretary said, the book is clearly going to be sold in the bargain fiction section.
Apparently, this guy Michael Wolff had pretty unfettered access to the campaign, and then the White House through October, when the more than 200 interviews
right.
wrapped up. So I tend to believe Michael Wolff, the author, over these statements that are coming out after.
Well, what are you going to say if you're president of the United States and somebody has just unleashed what might be the truth about you?
Yeah, I spent the last couple of hours really reading the excerpts that New York Magazine published today, and it is scathing stuff. It's pretty unbelievable. Everything we thought was what was going on seems to be what was going on. They had no belief whatsoever that they would ever win. Donald Trump was just, you know, using this to get himself richer and more famous. And was pretty much shocked when the results came in on election night, and it turned out that he actually won the Electoral College vote.
Well, actually, I think that it is interesting. I mean, I just don't know what to say. We never have a dull day at this White House.
No.
There is never a dull day. And like yesterday, he tweeted out 4 different tweets. I mean, one about Hillary Clinton, where he called her crooked Hillary. Another one about the North Korea. Another one about Palestine. I mean, another one about Iran. It's like
Pakistan.
You can't keep up with these
no,
people.
No, and it's frightening. The stuff. I mean, the tweet about the button. His button is bigger than Kim Jong-un's. I mean, it is stomach churning.
You cannot
stuff.
Make this stuff up.
No.
If you and I were to sit there and write a script 20 years ago, they would have just said, "Oh, nothing like this is ever going to happen."
Right, we'd be laughed out of the office.
It is unbelievable to me. Okay, there is actually some other news going on today. First of all, they swore in Al Franken's replacement, a woman who was lieutenant governor of Minnesota, and also Senator Jones from Alabama was sworn in today. So now it's 49-51, and they can only afford to lose one vote to get legislation through. And all of a sudden, Mitch McConnell is talking about making agreements with the Democrats I think they realize they're not going to win in 2018 unless they do that.
Well, they have a lot of stuff they need to get done, even in the next 2 weeks, right? The money runs out. I think the omnibus spending bill they passed only goes through January 19th.
The 19th.
Right.
That's correct. It's the 19th of January, and the State of the Union is January 30th, sorry. So they're going to have to do something because he needs to have some kind of budget. He can't have a government shutdown on State of the Union night. That would not look very good.
No, it wouldn't. There's a lot more they need to do, too. I mean, that's just there's a debt ceiling fight coming up that's separate and apart from the spending bill. Do you think they'll try to combine the two?
Well, I don't honestly know. I think it depends on what the Democrats negotiate. Now, it's interesting. The DACA, which is the Deferred Child Action Program, the Democrats are on board with that, trying to force some of the Republicans to do that. And you have some people like Susan Collins that are on DACA as well. But I was in the Senate chamber when DACA went down with the Democrats controlling it. So, all I have to say is the Democrats are coming at it a day late and a dollar short in some respects. I'm glad they're finally doing it, but they didn't do it in 2010.
No, they didn't. They didn't. And so there's DACA, and the other big thing that's still out there hovering is CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, that they extended for 3 months, but 3 months is nothing.
Well, they extended the budget, too, which was supposed to turn into a pumpkin on October 1st.
Right.
And then they extended it until mid-December, and now they're extending it to mid-January. But so far, nothing has been done on any of that.
Ay, ay, ay. They're scary. It's scary times we're living in.
Oh, what can I say? It is very scary all the way around. And so I think that... we are also living in a time when Donald Trump now wants to increase drug testing for people who have unemployment. And we're not talking about people who have unemployment in jobs that, if they apply for new ones, count, such as air traffic controllers. But they've extended the number of types of jobs that they would do drug testing. Well, that's, that is an infringement of privacy, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you 100%. This Donald Trump and the guy who ran for president as Donald Trump are two different people. The promises he made have nothing to do with what he's doing now that he's in office. He had said that there was going to be no cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. I mean, he promised a whole lot of things that he's just going back on now.
Well, that's right. And, obviously what you promise is when you're running for president, what you do are two different things. And that happens with every president. But then you also don't have every president tweeting out these things that are very divisive. And, I want a president of the United States to be president, not divisive.
Yes. Tell me about it. What else is going on, Ellen?
I think that there's, one of the things that we know about is that there has been a lot going on with the seat that was vacated in Utah. I think that it does look like Mitt Romney is going to run for that seat. He has certainly changed his Twitter account. He's changed everything else. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. All right. He's changed everything else. But there are some people that are saying that part of the reason that he is running for that seat is not just that he wants to be senator, but he wants to run against Donald Trump, period. And yesterday, it was interesting, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked whether Donald Trump would support Mitt Romney for that seat, and they would not commit to that.
Really? Wow. So childish. Now, Mitt Romney's what's her, the head of the RNC is Mitt Romney's not daughter, but she's a relative, Ronna.
That's right. I don't
Romney
right.
McDaniels or something. She's got a Romney in her name, like Sarah Huckabee Sanders has a Huckabee in her name, but she's not Romney's daughter, but she is related.
Right. And the fact is that, you know, people put their relatives in all kinds of jobs at that point. Mm-hmm. And so we do know that that happens. However, does it mean that Donald Trump is going to support Romney? Because Romney has been very critical of Donald Trump.
Yeah, he has been, except for that short little time when Romney went to kiss the ring and eat frog's legs with Trump.
Well, when he
Trump
thought he was going to be Secretary of State or something.
Right, and Trump made him look like a fool. So I think there's more there even than there was before.
Right. I mean, I think that what you have is you have someone who obviously is a politician. And I have to tell you that politicians, in my view, I don't care whether they're Democrats or Republicans, when you take off the whatever, they're all the same in many places.
Oh, yeah. Politician first.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay. Some other interesting things. What we found is that they have found that air pollution is linked to early deaths with older folks because we've been breathing in pollution for a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
They're also finding that millennials are spending more money on ready-to-eat foods rather than actually doing any cooking.
Okay.
They have found that the NSA is losing a lot of talent. Now, what's interesting about that is part of it is that their travel budget has been cut so that people aren't going to conferences as much. And they're being offered a lot more money by working for some of these think tanks. But the question is, are any of the think tanks actually run by foreign governments that we don't know about? That's the other thing we don't know.
No, that's a good question. But then again, it's not only the NSA that, you know, they're losing top talent, but a lot of other governmental agencies just aren't being staffed up. And Trump seems almost proud of that fact. Yeah, we're going to cut the payroll.
Well, that's right. I mean, he wants to say that he's, you know, drained the swamp, that he's cut down on people who have worked for the government. And
right.
That may be. One thing I just want to talk to you about. And that is that Fusion GPS, remember, they're the people mm-hmm. that actually did this dossier on Donald Trump or had the dossier done on Donald Trump. Well, they testified before Congress and closed testimony for 21 hours. They said they want their testimony open. Of course, the government is not moving in that direction.
Why not release it? What are they afraid of?
Well, I don't know, but they gave an op-ed today in the New York Times.
That's right. Yep, op-ed today in the New York Times. Ellen Ratner, never a dull moment, I guess. Thank you, Ellen.
We've certainly never been dull. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Find Ellen at Talk Media News Service, talkmedianews.com. And, of course, they update us on the news here Wednesdays through Fridays on the Nicole Sandler Show. We're going to take a break, a quick time out, and come back on the other side with John Nichols of The Nation. Stick around. It's Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Mega-rich agribusiness interests that have been abusing farm workers suddenly want help for themselves. Hear about it today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. Every decade or so, America's mass media are surprised to discover that migrant farm workers are still being miserably paid and despicably treated by the industry that profits from their labor. Stories run, the public is outraged again, assorted officials pledge action, then nothing changes. News reports recently have redocumented that the shameful abuse of these hard-working, hard-traveling families continues. A Los Angeles Times report revealed that even if they receive the legal minimum wage, many farm laborers earn less than $17,500 a year because of the low pay and the seasonal nature of their work. Moreover, they're often housed in shacks, old chicken coops, shipping containers, and squalid motels. This year, though, multi-billion-dollar agribusiness interests from Florida to California are uniting in a push for new assistance, not for workers, but themselves. While they backed Trump for president, many are now expressing shock that he may actually try to fulfill his campaign promise to cut off the flow of undocumented immigrants to their fields. They now admit that these immigrants make up as much as 70% of the industry's workforce, so they've rushed to Washington, demanding a special exemption from their president's planned lockout of Mexican laborers. In the process, they've suddenly recharacterized the very migrants they've been so callously mistreating as noble employees who are essential to the USA's food security. This is Jim Hightower saying, Big Ag deserves no special break at all. But if Trump and Congress give any help to them, they should be required to pay a living wage, provide decent family housing and health care, and treat all farm workers with the respect due to people who really are essential to our food security. To help push for basic human justice, connect with the United Farm Workers at ufw.org.
If you like these feisty pops of populism that Hightower zings out on the airwaves, check out the Hightower Lowdown. Jim's monthly newsletter provides the in-depth lowdown on what the greed heads of Wall Street and the boneheads of Washington are doing to us behind the scenes. With Hightower's saucy Texas humor and truth-telling populist perspective, the lowdown literally can lift you up. And get this, you can have the lowdown delivered to your mailbox or email each month for only $15 a year. Yes, 12 issues, only 15 bucks. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.org.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right. It is Nicole Sandler back with you here at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. We are getting... And there he is, John Nichols, of course, from The Nation magazine, where he's the national affairs correspondent. Also the author of a number of books, the latest one being Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. Hello, John Nichols, and Happy New Year.
Hello, Nicole, and Happy New Year to you.
Well, thank you. You know, something we've done, I don't know, I think almost every year for the last number of years is, I sort of dovetail on you. You guys at The Nation come up with your progressive honor roll each year, and I thought since this year is already getting off to a very strange start, why not take a look at a few of the things worth honoring that happened in 2017, people and events and organizations, and you know, at a time when there's so much negativity around us, it's good to shine a spotlight on some of the good stuff.
It really is, and in fact, it helps us, I think, to understand a little bit of how well the resistance to Donald Trump and the envisioning of a more progressive and hopefully even, I might dare say, radical future, has succeeded over the course of this past year. An awful lot of the mainstream media coverage focuses on Trump's tweet, response to it, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you miss the fact that there are people at the national, state, and local level who are actually achieving things with a very different vision. And sometimes blocking Trump, other times, you know, just setting out in new directions altogether and getting places. And so what we really want to do every year with the Progressive Honor Roll is to ask people to pause and look back on the year, not with the frustration and the legitimate fear that such a reflection might engender, especially in a year of Donald Trump, but also with a little bit of hope, a little bit of sense that in the darkness there was some light.
Right. Now, you don't, in the progressive honor roll for 2017, you don't have, like, the progressive word of the year, but the article in The Nation does begin with resistance was the watchword for 2017. And it really was, and it was never more apparent. We're coming up on the first anniversary of the Women's March, which you do single out as the, what was it, the most valuable
protest.
Yeah. On a national level.
Yeah,
anyway.
Exactly. Well, you're exactly right. And I'm glad you started there because I think, and obviously we say it in this piece, that the Women's March was more significant in hindsight now than we even knew at the time. It was exceptionally significant at the moment. But we look back over the course of the year, what you realize is two important things. First off, the Women's March put an immediate stop to the manufactured false celebration of Donald Trump's inauguration. And what I mean by that was that, you know, Trump had the microphone and had, you know, at least a good measure of the attention for January 20th. And he was very busy. You know, remember, this is a president who's willing to lie, to spin at levels that he's never been, that people have never been spun before, to play the media in every angle. And suddenly, the next day, you had a bigger crowd, you had more energy, you had the clear, undebatable evidence of resistance and opposition. And I really think that set the tone for the year. I think it made it much more possible for people in Congress, to the extent that they did, and also at the grassroots, to push back against Trump. And one good example of that is that just weeks after the Women's March, you saw, or actually days after the Women's March, you saw the remarkable resistance at the grassroots level to Trump's Muslim ban. And do not underestimate, never underestimate, that resistance, that physical resistance to the Muslim ban at the airports, I think cleared space for the courts to step in and to, you know, tell Trump he was wrong. So a lot of things, and I trace it all to the Women's March. I think it was essential.
And it gave so many of us some hope at a time when a lot of us were feeling pretty hopeless.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, if you will, the kind of steady pattern of the year is that this was a year in which a dishonest president and a frequently manipulated national media, you know, really beat us down quite often. There's a lot of days where people felt, you know, like, wow, this is overwhelming. Threats of nuclear war, the potential thereof, defeats of good initiatives, the terribly frustrating process of watching Trump assemble a cabinet, the Gorsuch nomination. You can go through all these things and say, wow, you know, on any given day, you feel pretty horrible. It can add up to something that could even be disempowering. And then you get these wonderful shows of resistance and that physical resistance, going to the streets, and raising the alarm, I think matters now more than ever.
Without a doubt. We're speaking with John Nichols of The Nation magazine, talking about the 2017 Progressive Honor Roll. It's something The Nation does every year that John spearheads there. How do you come up with the categories and who you deem the winner in each category?
Well, we don't have enough categories. If we had one for shows like this, you'd win, just so you know.
No,
I'm not kidding. I mean, we should expand the categories because especially as we start to see more and more new platforms for speaking about things. But what we do is we take a basic set of categories. And then starting in the fall, I, to some extent, but also people like Katrina Bannon, who are our editor, other writers, and grassroots activists and others, kind of, you know, there's a sort of a discourse. Ideas, some people throw in ideas. I get emails all the time from folks who say, you ought to be paying attention to this. I talk to Katrina, she hears things, she has ideas, other members of the staff have ideas. And then I always run it by activists and people around the country. We throw a name up and say, well, what do you think about this? And somebody will say, no, I don't think that's quite the right person. You keep looking. And over time, we've produce the list, not saying it's authoritative, it's the only list that might be, but suggesting that here's some people that you might have missed, or especially as you move down that list, might not have thought about.
Right. And it's a little bit different each year. For instance, we just mentioned the Women's March is the most valuable protest on a national level. You also have the most valuable protest local, which is one that a lot of people might have missed.
Exactly. And this was a really remarkable moment in our history. Down in Mississippi, they were dedicating a civil rights museum. Mm-hmm. And if there's any place that needs a civil rights museum, it's Mississippi. No doubt about that. And it's in Jackson, you know, down there. And the mayor of Jackson is newly elected, Chakwe Lumumba, remarkable figure, really somebody who says he wants his city to be the most radical city in the country, and very bold, young thinker about all sorts of possibilities, doing a great job by a variety of measures. Now, here you had this dedication of the Civil Rights Museum, and Mayor Lumumba is somebody who extends from the civil rights movements of the 60s and the 70s, somebody, you know, as a child who was rooted in these traditions and grew up influenced by it. Nobody better to have been there in many ways celebrating the opening of this. But Donald Trump decided to insert himself into it for all the political reasons you might imagine. And Mayor Lumumba had to make a choice. Will he stand at the side of Donald Trump and in some ways legitimize Donald Trump? Or really, in the great tradition of the civil rights movement, stand on the outside and say, you know, there are statements that must be made. There's an opposition that must be expressed. And he gave up his chance to be a part of the show and part of all the program there and stood outside and objected and said, this is wrong. And it was a really very moving protest. I invite people to Google the details on this and take a look at the speech he gave. He spoke of, you know, being called by the martyrs of the civil rights movement to do the right thing. Mm. And he did do the right thing.
On the list, you have the most valuable grassroots activism. And you know, as I was going through it, I was thinking, well, Indivisible is going to get it. And
this
then,
is great.
Right. Yeah. And then I see ADAPT and Disability Action for America. And I thought, you know what? Yes, because they were the ones leading the charge against repealing the Affordable Care Act. These people in wheelchairs were getting arrested in D.C. People came from all over the country. Oh, gee, what's his name? The young father who's got Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
Addy, and I can't think of his last name. Drawing a blank.
I know who you're talking about. The activist.
Yes.
But there's, you know, my friend, there's so many of these people.
Yes.
There was a hero a minute out there. I was there during those days of, you know, the key was that again and again there the year, the Republicans tried to do what was really their core proposal, right, which is eliminate the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, imagine the horror of this. If you're the mother, not even a person who's directly suffering, you know, who's got the, you know, has Lou Gehrig's disease or some other, you know, terrible challenge in their life, but the parents who are taking care of kids who they know will have challenges and will have needs, but also have tremendous potential. These parents and their children came again and again and again to Washington, and also adults with disabilities came again and again and again to Washington, and they put themselves physically in the way of members of Congress and said, you have to pay attention to the terrible threat that you are making to our lives. And I promise you, I know it from watching it, that these actions by people with disabilities did two things. Number one, they made it impossible for Democrats to even consider compromising on this or to even, you know, consider going another way. And they caused Republicans in the House and the Senate, at least a few and critical few in each of these cases, to recognize they could not vote to eliminate, not only to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, but also to undermine Medicaid, which was an equally significant part of it. So I really think these people, frankly, I think they certainly weren't the only people resisting by any measure, but they won battles for all of us.
Most definitely. Most definitely. And we do have to give a nod, I will say, to Indivisible, who helped get of every stripe, people who were never involved in any kind of activism, off their butts and often out from behind the computer keyboard to actually take physical action. Because we saw participation.
Yeah, go ahead.
I
think that Indivisible did something that was wonderful and deserving of credit. Mm-hmm. The same with, frankly, Move On, a couple of other established groups.
Yep.
They were willing to empower the most effective forms of resistance. And so, as an example, folks with Indivisible and also folks with Move On were there in Washington when people with disabilities were in the front of this. And instead of elbowing them aside or saying, I'll be the spokesman here, they made sure that people with disabilities got a chance to be heard, and they directed energy toward these protests, which made everything more powerful. And it's a new way of doing resistance. It's saying that the person who's out front doesn't have to be, the member of Congress or the well-known long-term activist. It can be somebody folks don't even know.
That's
if you give that person time to tell their story, they can change the course of history. And I give credit in the honor roll to Ben Wickler from Move On in Washington, who did so much, worked so closely with the ADAPT folks and others to make sure that they were heard.
I get his emails. I see them all the time.
I'm sure you do. Yeah.
John Nichols, every year you do point out the most valuable senator. Bernie Sanders might have been retired from that category because he was named that so many years in a row. And he is singled out in another category. But this year you gave the most valuable senator honor to Elizabeth Warren.
Well, you're so astute, Nicole, and I think that, look, to my view, Bernie Sanders is in a category unto himself, and we do cite him in the honor roll as the most effective inside-outside player, somebody who's doing effective things in the Senate, but also out rallying people across the country, and I think that's an epic role, and one of the reasons why he remains so popular. But in the Senate, I thought that it was important to recognize the role that Elizabeth Warren played, and remember, nobody shook Donald Trump more. Nobody troubled Donald Trump and the Republicans more than Elizabeth Warren. And she was so effective in challenging, their rush to get their nominees approved and in all the other initiatives of the administration that they actually went out of their way to shut her down. I mean, think about that. The United States Senate told Elizabeth Warren she couldn't be part of the debate about the next Attorney General of the United States because she dared to read a letter from Coretta Scott King into the record. And that moment, that incredible moment, it wasn't the only moment where, President Trump and others went after her. That was a recognition of how powerful her opposition was. And it gave us, it gave us the slogan, and maybe the slogan of the year, which was, nevertheless, she persisted.
Yes.
And that's a slogan that has meaning not merely in the core political struggles, but also for the Me Too movement and so many other movements that have come out of this year.
You have most valuable reading of the Constitution given to Kirsten Gillibrand. She's somebody who's sort of emerging from the pack as one who may be running for president in 2020. I have my issues with Senator Gillibrand, but she is effective, and one of her things has always been sexual assault in the military. This is something that she got really out in front of even before 2017. She kept it going this year as well, or last year now as well.
Very much. And she upset a lot of people.
She did.
And you know what? Sometimes you have to upset people, right? You have to shake things up. She took on her own party and obviously the Republicans on a host of these issues because I think she wanted to establish a standard. Now, people may disagree with her on some of this, but her consistency and her focus is something that I think needs to be recognized. And where you saw that most significantly as regards the her role in the Senate, especially on providing advice and consent to presidential nominations, was in her opposition to Trump's picks. She voted against more of Trump's key picks, his cabinet picks and key positions, than any other senator. And that in itself is remarkable. But the reason she cast so many no votes, and so many more than others, is even more significant. It was because of her passion for civilian control of the military. Mm-hmm. Her argument that recently retired generals and sitting generals shouldn't be rushed into positions of power, that you have to have some division there between civilian authority and that of those, you know, who are in the military. And that caused her to vote against General Mattis, who almost everybody else was jumping on board. And she said, you know, hold it. This is a big step that we're taking without much serious analysis. And she, even under a tremendous amount of pressure, again and again, raised those constitutional concerns about civilian control of the military. And I promise you, we'll return to these concerns. There will be points at which this becomes a serious matter, I think, during this presidency. And she'll be proven to have been right to have been concerned.
Very possibly. You know, John Nichols, there's a weird... there's a weird bit of irony going on around the generals that the president has surrounded himself with. And that is some people are saying, well, these men are going to be the voice of reason around him. And some point to the fact that the president has the authority to launch a nuclear attack unilaterally. He doesn't need the approval of Congress. You need Congress to declare war, but not to launch a nuclear weapon. And I did hear someone one day saying something, well, this is where the generals will come in and they'll stop him. And all I could think of is if a general stops the president from doing something, that's a coup. That's a military coup. And I don't know that, yes, I want someone to stop Trump from launching a nuclear attack, but I don't know that I want it in the form of a military coup either.
That's right. And it's a fantasy to assume that, you know, these generals, just because they're generals or they have certain experience, that they're necessarily going to do the right thing. In Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, I wrote a lot about General Kelly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, far from preventing this president from doing the wrong thing, I think you saw again and again through the fall evidence that General Kelly was a part of the problem.
Yes.
And so this goes beyond partisanship, and that's why we had the title heading, Reading of the Constitution. There are points at which we ought to be united, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, you know, wherever your political bent. And one of those should be that in questions of war and peace, it is absolutely essential that the will of the people of the United States be reflected, that it not just be a military decision, because there may be times where the easiest decision is to start a war. But that's not what the American people want or need. And so I think that Gillibrand did something very important there in casting those votes and in very aggressively explaining why she was voting no. But it wasn't that she disliked General Mattis. It was the deeper principle that she didn't think any general should be so quickly put into a position of authority over the military after, you know, retiring or even as a sitting general be put into some sort of influential position.
Right. Sherrod Brown is named most valuable Senate watchdog. What did he do?
Oh, man. On the day that we see Orrin Hatch, or day after we see Orrin Hatch leaving the Senate, all I can say is if you go back and look at those videos of Sherrod Brown challenging Orrin Hatch and saying, you know, look, you got to admit that this tax bill is all about the rich. I mean, Hatch blew up. He got furious. I think it was a very, very bold gesture because, again, you know, no matter what your partisanship, it was quite obvious that the tax bill was being rushed through the Senate without adequate consideration, without anything akin to the sort of skepticism that was necessary. And Brown basically pulled the brakes. He also did so on a number of other issues, and he was very, very bold in telling his colleagues, especially the Republicans, but even Democrats, that what was happening was really a breach of faith with the American people, that they were moving legislation that the vast majority of Americans didn't want and that would harm Americans economically, structurally, in all sorts of ways. And it was especially powerful to watch him standing up for some of the most vulnerable people in the country, you know, the ability of people to make sure that they are heard when they are harmed by consumer products, when their circumstance is, when they have to go up against a multinational corporation. And he did it again and again. It was, you don't always get a lot of publicity for these fights. You don't always get a lot of pats on the back for this. Maybe even you lose some campaign contributions, but Sherrod Brown was really willing to take the fight to the committee rooms and to the Senate floor on a host of economic issues. And it really was an example of the best of economic populism.
You point out the value of a couple of House members as well, Jan Schakowsky, who's kind of, you don't see her on TV every day tooting her own horn, but you named Jan Schakowsky of Illinois the most valuable House progressive, and Ro Khanna, most valuable House newcomer. And it's interesting because Ro Khanna in a primary defeated somebody that, you know, that a lot of us really loved. And so
absolutely. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was a sad day to see. And now I'm drawing a blank on Mike Honda.
Mike Honda.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was
and
sad.
Mike Honda was a terrific member.
He really was. And I wasn't so sure about this Ro Khanna guy. And he turned out to be a really, really great freshman congressman.
Exactly. And you know, look, I agree with you. I think that there are many people who had a great affection for Mike Honda. Khanna beat him in part because of the new or the unique California election laws that allow two Democrats to go up against one another, even in a general election,
right,
if that be the circumstance. And Khanna had things to prove. I think he would be the first to acknowledge that. But he leapt into his position. And where he did it, again, as we were talking about Gillibrand, you know, look, we can have great respect for our military. We can have great respect for generals and commanders and in the role that they play. But the role that they play should be defined by Congress. Congress is supposed to declare wars. Congress is supposed to recognize, you know, when wars should be fought and how they should be funded. And Congress has been so unimaginably irresponsible in this regard. It has ceded so much of its authority for so long. And often, in a very lonely battle, Barbara Lee of California, who's one of the great heroes of our Congress, has, you know, tried to say, hold it, we can't just continually use a 2001 authorization of the use of force to justify new military endeavors. We can't neglect when our presidents are, you know, moving into a war footing without the authorization of Congress. She always has needed allies, and she got one in Ro Khanna. He jumped into this battle over Yemen and made sure that people heard, you know, this alternative voice, you know, this message that Congress has not approved massive U.S. funding of the Saudis in this regard, that Congress has not said we want to see, you know, really something incredibly horrific taking place in Yemen with our support, at least our official military support, but not with the advice and consent of the American people. So I can't begin to tell you what an important role that Ro Khanna played in putting these issues on the table and in assuring that that Congress actually had a vote this year on the question of Yemen. Now, it was not as what the vote I would have wanted, which is, you know, telling the military that, you know, you have to back off, you have to get approval of Congress. But it was saying that Congress had not authorized this.
Right.
It was making that clear.
Right.
And I can tell you from discussions with Khanna over this year and with Barbara Lee and others that this issue isn't going away. And what's remarkable about Ro Khanna and Barbara Lee, and I see them in combination on so many of these issues, is that they always insist when they raise these issues that it be done in a bipartisan way, that they have Republicans, usually very libertarian-leaning Republicans, on board with them as they say no. And that's huge.
This is
a vision for how to assert the authority of Congress that ought to go beyond Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, and I think kind of gets it.
And hopefully there'll be more of that in 2018. I wanted to shine a spotlight on some of the really good stuff, the good work that was done in 2017. And I thank you, John Nichols, and The Nation for doing this every year. It's always a segment I look forward to. So thank you so much for joining us today. As always, I always appreciate your time and your input.
Thank you, Nicole. It's actually one of the funnest parts of doing this is spending a little time talking to you about it.
Thank you so much.
So keep up your great show, and I'm going to work on getting that new category in.
Okay, I'll hold you to it. I'll call on you again soon. Thank you again, John Nichols of The Nation. Find him on Twitter at Nichols Uprising and read the book Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Nicole.
Bye-bye.